This is Johnny Bluestar. Welcome to Threshold, a global media event. Is the universe just a random dance of atoms? Or is it a manifestation of a supremely intelligent architect? Can its purpose, or our purpose here on Earth, be adequately assessed? Can we commune with it, know its intentions, cooperate with its direction? Here, we define Threshold as a gateway state of awareness, allowing mankind to cross into a place of real cognition. Threshold allows us to approach questions of higher reality through the door of experience rather than mere belief. Welcome to Threshold, where we tear away the veil from commercial media, bringing our audience and participants into another realm of reality and enhanced communication. Welcome back to Threshold. One of the promises that I made when I started this program was to bring information to our listeners that would bring both practical and spiritual empowerment to our audience. I believe and continue to believe that many of the thoughts and feelings that drive us come from a higher level within ourselves, and we should listen. But I also believe that part of what we need to do on this tough earthly plane is to learn to distinguish between what is coming from a higher source within us and what is coming from our lower sense of selfhood, that part of us that lives apart from the experience of our true nature, that often will divert us from our real dreams and our appointed destiny. Sometimes these dreams lead us to believing that we should do something ourselves, open our own business. For many, if you have those dreams, then you need to know some things about that. I believe so much in the value of opening your own business that in my recent program, my fantasy presidential campaign platform, I actually envisioned a United States policy to provide everyone who becomes of age with their own national business license, a right to own a small business that conforms to the rules of state and local principalities. Further, remembering that Adam Smith spoke of America as a nation of shopkeepers, I revised the idea to reference a projected nation of business owners, where everyone functioned as an independent contractor so that no one was really an employee or an employer. Now, of course, I realize this is not the case right now, that one is not born to be a business owner, and that, in fact, a serious decision must be contemplated, one in which there are grave risks and also tremendous possible satisfaction. So I've brought as a guest Charles Rick Perry, an attorney who will help those listeners who are contemplating such a move to help separate fantasy from the authentic dream and the real-world moves that he or she must undertake to develop their own business. Thanks for coming, Rick. First of all, Rick, let us know a little bit about your background and the route that you took to becoming an attorney.
Well, I was one of those who had already figured out by the time high school ended what he wanted to do in life. I knew pretty early on I wanted to be a lawyer. I don't know that I could tell you why I thought that, but I did. I mean, I think it comes down to really a personal reason. I love a good argument. I love a good debate. I love politics and have an interest in all things of that nature. And the other was it was a good fit for me to basically help people. I'm not somebody who is great with his hands. I'm not somebody who does well with the sight of blood. But I do have a skill set, I think, that can help people navigate a fairly complicated legal and business landscape to avoid certain problems, to help solve other problems, to minimize yet a third set of problems, and to move on. So, all the way through high school, college, even though I kind of did different things, I knew that in the law, I was going to end up there, that I was going to be a lawyer in some capacity. So really, that's the background. I went to Berkeley. I went to law school at Berkeley. I did the really big mega firm route for a long time. Ended up deciding that that wasn't the route that I should pursue, even though I adored many of the people I worked with and I liked the practice and the work was interesting. It just wasn't quite the right fit for me. So starting in about 1995, 96 or so, I decided to open my own office. and I branched out and have worked as a solo practitioner ever since, with a break in there for a little frolic and detour, midlife crisis, personal growth, what have you. But you know, if you follow the arc of my career, you will always see that I end up being a lawyer. I mean, that was just the professional course that was destined for me. If you
well, I like that destined part. I wonder if you had any sort of role models or icons, either in the media, someone like I don't know where Perry Mason was on television when you were younger, but you know, or famous lawyers and taking certain cases on publicly.
You know, Perry Mason, it's kind of funny that you mentioned it. One of my early memories of television was Saturday afternoons and Sunday afternoons at home, because my mother was a huge Perry Mason fan. You know, it's funny that you mentioned Perry Mason. I don't know if this is a coincidence or not, but one of my earliest memories when I was quite small, maybe 4 or 5, was being home on Saturday afternoons and Sunday afternoons, and my mother would be watching Perry Mason. She was a huge Perry Mason, Raymond Burr fan. and so I have these, you know, images of black and white television with Raymond Burr and his secretary, whose name now escapes me. Della, I believe, was her name.
I think so.
Della Street, if I remember correctly. Uh-huh. It doesn't make any difference. And Paul Drake, you know, in my brain. Did they shape my career decision? Oh, I suspect that they really didn't at the end of the day. You know, television, drama, law is so different from the practice that it would have taken about 30 seconds of real life practicing law to know that, you know, Perry Mason was great fiction, but it was definitely fiction. In terms of role models, sure, I think I do have role models from people whom I learned from the practice. That I worked with early on throughout my, and, you know, the very, very beginning stages of my career, who showed me what it was to be a good lawyer. Every once in a while, you saw things, particularly from people on the other side, as to what it meant to be a bad lawyer. You know, how to handle the courts with dignity, how to handle your clients with dignity, how to flat out tell your clients sometimes, you know, I'm sorry, but you are wrong, with dignity, and to really, you know, use the position of a lawyer as a position of trust and respect, and helping people to navigate, as I said earlier, a very complicated system in which we live, because we live in a very complicated world, and complicated worlds often have complicated rules. So, you know, yes, I do have role models, but they wouldn't be anybody that you knew. They were really personal people in my career who shaped my life, many of whom I practiced with earlier on.
What about professors in law school? Were there any that particularly stimulated you or got you really interested in a certain facet of law?
I am probably one of the minority of people who think law school is a colossal waste of time, because it really is so different from what you do as a practitioner. And maybe this was my own misimpression. I kind of sort of viewed law school as sort of a pre-professional training in part, and it isn't that. It's completely academic, which is fine. You know, we certainly need academics and we certainly need that perspective. And I, you know, it may well have been my fault that I walked into it with the wrong mindset. But I happen to think that law school could be condensed significantly such that people who really want to be practitioners can learn how to practice and leave the theory to the academics. That having been said, yeah, there were some professors that I had at Bolt, at Berkeley, that were top-notch scholars, that were really interesting people, that were great teachers, that made their students think, that, you know, that taught them how to argue, how to shape arguments, and to be, you know, a good lawyer, at least giving them the academic and theoretical frameworks to being a good lawyer. You know, there Mary Kay Kane was one of them. Mike Trainer was another one. Mel Eisenberg was a third. You know, these are named. Gene Choker at Berkeley, whom I didn't have the pleasure of having as a professor, but guided a lot of things at Berkeley. You know, these were great names when I was going to law school, and I was very fortunate to be able to study under them. And I did learn a lot from them, notwithstanding my own bias against law school and what law school has to offer the actual practitioner.
Very interesting. Now, I know that in addition to being an attorney, during career, you did experiment a little bit with entrepreneurship. Is that not right?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I did. And I know where you're going with this, and I'll get there in a second. You know, to be a solo practitioner is in itself a form of entrepreneurship. We have clients, we have customers, we sell services, we prepare invoices, we have leases, we have partners. So actually, my whole career for the past 20, 25 years has been one form of entrepreneurship or another, whether it be in the law practice or in my grand detour, which was to work with my partner to open a restaurant in the southwestern part of France. This was sometime in the early 2000s, where we kind of looked at each other and basically said, it's time to do something completely different. So we closed up our respective shops and we picked up and we moved. I had the great luck of having a lot of family here in France and a cousin who was in the government at the time, and he offered to help streamline any problems we might have with the bureaucracy. Fortunately, we never needed to tap into his services very much. We came and we landed in the city of Albi, and we opened a restaurant that we ran successfully for about 9 years. But like all adventures, that one too ran its course, and we closed it down and we sold it at a profit, and then went back to our respective lives.
Well, that sounds like a great experience.
It was. I mean, it was quite the eye opener to learn that how a different culture acts in terms of structuring small businesses and running small businesses and licensing and permitting, and where are the similarities and where are the differences, and how human resources questions are answered differently and people are treated in the relationship, you know, between boss and employee, and just operating a completely different culture. And it seemed like every day for at least the first couple of years was clearly culture shock. And, you know, and saying, oh, I never thought about how it could possibly be done any differently than the way we do it in the States. Obviously, they thought the same thing about us. So it was an incredible experience, not one in which we made a huge amount of money, but it was profitable. We did earn our keep, and not something that I would trade for all the money or love in the world.
We are happy to provide our audience with two very exciting musical odysseys with Stephanie Slevin, a singer-songwriter from the United Kingdom. One is called Show Number 7, A Galaxy of Song, and the other is Show 21, I Talk with Angels, in our Threshold Radio archives in VegasAllNetRadio.com and YouTube. Here is one of our songs.
Hats up to angels, and they speak to me. They show me things that I don't usually see. Well, 'cause somewhere in heaven, God looks down with love, showing off mankind. But we just push and shove one another to the ground, making an unholy sound. But if you want to talk to angels, you gotta spread your heart around every town. I saw an angel at the end of my bed. He looked at me, but not a word was said. Well, 'cause somewhere in heaven, God believed in me, as he does us all, just awaits us to see. He is there everywhere, all around, every town. Yes, I talk to angels, and they speak to me. They lead me places they want me to be. Well, 'cause somewhere in heaven, God looks down with love, showing us mankind. But we just push and shove one another to the ground, making unholy sound. But if you want to talk to angels, you gotta spread your heart around every town, every town.
My company, New Galaxy Enterprises, is a California corporation specializing in the creation of media and promotional content. We are focused on original, innovative projects that are good for humanity. These projects could be nonfiction books or novels, fictional screenplays or documentary content, websites and website content, commercial advertising content for print, audio, or video products on the internet, television, or radio, musical scores for advertising, television, or film, video, audio editing, etc. We want to promote products and projects that support the environment, encourage a healthy experience in living, developing, nurturing, and useful technology, and offering platforms for positive, socially constructive entertainment or informative, transformative media. Our experience in creating a variety of products like this is rather vast, and we offer client-based and collaborative products, as well as the opportunity of active investors to join us in the creation and promotion of proprietary products, some of which are in latter stages of development. For more information, go to www.newgalaxyenterprises.com. That's www.newgalaxyenterprises.com. If you're interested in talking to us, just fill out the contact sheet and we will get back with you.
Boots in Manhattan is a coming-of-age novel by Ray Boylan and Johnny Bluestar. It is about a young Tom Boots Raymond who grows up in New York in the 1940s, who is a member of a street gang.
My friends and I were about to start our own game of stickball when Rabbit Lacey, the head of the Rattlers, came up to us and tried to move in on our game. We were called dwarves, the youngest members of this stupid gang.
Hey, Kevin, I need you to get some gloves and some stuff I left at my place.
No, this is our game.
Hey, are you my good little dwarf or what?
You've been calling me a dwarf since I was six. We're not your personal slaves, pal.
Hey, what is this? A dwarf rebellion? All right, big guy. We ditched the dwarf thing. We make you guys regular rattlers.
No, it's too late.
He looked at Jay and me. We looked away. Rabbit was now angry, and he pushed Kevin hard with the palms of his hand. Kevin tried to ram him in the stomach, but he stepped aside, throwing Kevin into the curb where he fell to the ground, bleeding profusely at the knee. Still, he managed to get up.
My street.
Kevin shouted at Rabbit, pointing at him with an angry index finger.
Find out more by Googling Boots in Manhattan, a 1940s coming-of-age novel, part one of the novel series The Foot Soldier by Ray Boylan and Johnny Bluestar. Google with the words Boots in Manhattan, Ray Johnny Kindle. That's Boots in Manhattan, Ray Johnny Kindle.
We're back with Charles Rick Perry, an attorney who's providing our listeners with the real deal about what it takes to start a small business. So, Rick, in a general sense, what do you think of entrepreneurship?
Entrepreneurship is not for the faint of heart. It's a huge risk. It takes an incredible amount of time. It takes a lot more money than you think that it will at the beginning. And it takes more information to put it to get it together and to do it than you even thought possible or even imagined existed. You spend so much time preparing and planning, and every time you think you've got one question answered, two or three or five more pop up as to how to handle things. And you can't predict everything that happens in the business. Somebody's going to throw you a curveball. I mean, it happens to me still every day. Something different, something new comes on where you kind of scratch your head and you go, wow, you know, where that came completely out of left field. I would be willing to bet that less than 50% of new businesses survive more than 3 years, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, I would say that's probably even a very positive view of it. I'm not sure, though.
Yeah, I suspect that is optimistic, you know, largely because I think people do underestimate how much time it's going to take, how much information they need, and how much money they're going to need to get started. You know, one of the difficult things to estimate is your cash flow that you're going to generate from your business and how long it's going to take you to turn a profit. Much, you know, and turning a profit means earning $1 as opposed to losing money and investing money. It doesn't mean simply, you know, enough money to earn your livelihood. It simply means being in the black. And how much it's going to take in terms of cash to get you to a sustainable position if that new business is going to be your source of livelihood.
Well, in the years of helping people open these businesses, which, as we've discussed, quite complex and quite dangerous in certain ways, what has struck you as the primary criteria to achieve business success?
Intestinal fortitude. You've got to be a risk taker, and you've got to understand your downsides as well as your upsides.
I see.
That's really what it takes, and you've got to be willing to make some hard decisions. You know, business is rough and tumble. You know, it is. You know, there is a framework, but, you know, world wrestling has a framework too, and that's rough and tumble as well. You've got to be willing to negotiate everything. You've got to be willing to be flexible. You've got to be willing to make quick decisions, and you've got to be willing to accept risk. You know, that's really, if you don't have that kind of intestinal fortitude to gamble what it takes to get your business off the ground, then you should not be running a business. Or you should be running a business that has a much smaller risk.
Yes, I've heard about that. I remember that I had a kind of successful time in New Orleans where I was trading. I was kind of trading upwards with different dealers in antiques and collectibles and selling them in the flea market. I did quite well. And then I moved eventually to Tulsa and I tried to do the same thing. And the market was completely different and I didn't get it. I didn't understand that markets, because I was pretty young then, were so absolutely different. And I just completely failed because there was no one to trade with, and there was no one wanted the sort of things that they wanted in New Orleans. So that was very sad because I thought that I had sort of a career there. And then I realized it was very much oriented towards a specific market.
Yeah, and a specific market, a specific culture, a specific time frame. You know, all of those things go into the information framework of running a business. Are you selling a product or providing a service that people need or want at a price they can afford? And if you're not doing that, then your business is likely not going to succeed.
What are the nuts and bolts for legal requirements to start, say, a one-person shop to start out with?
This is actually probably the easiest piece of the puzzle for the one-person shop, meaning, you know, no employees, minimal overhead, basically the man or the woman working out of their home or their garage. And essentially what you need is no more than a business license, which is an administrative process through usually city hall or the city government or local government, and most likely what's called a fictitious business name statement, because everybody wants to run their business under a name that isn't their own. So, you know, if I wanted to open up Rick's Coffee Shop, for instance, because it's not simply my name, my full name in the name of the company, I would need to get a fictitious business name statement, which gets published in the newspaper and provides notice to the world that Rick's Coffee Shop is actually run by me. They're both, you know, that's fairly simple. That's usually processed through the county clerk's office as opposed to City Hall. And they're both a business license and the fictitious business name statement is usually filling out a fairly short form, one page, two pages at the most, signing it, paying the associated fees with the fictitious business name statement. You would need to publish that in a newspaper, and the county clerk is usually quite good about giving you a list of the newspapers that are acceptable for publishing in that particular county. And you contact the newspaper and publish it for 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, whatever local law requires. And that's about it. In terms of the strict legal formalities of opening a one-man business, that's really the absolute essentials. Now, depending upon the kind of business you run, there may be additional permitting or licensing requirements. Probably the most obvious one is if you are in the food and beverage industry, you know, where you are serving drinks or opening a restaurant or doing catering, because many counties have certain health restrictions and inspection requirements and the like for places where the public can come to eat and to drink. And, you know, to try to list them all would be absurd given the number of possibilities of types of businesses that you run. A client came to me recently and said, hey, I'd like to do a certain set of oils that would help people with burns and to heal faster.
Essential oils.
Beg pardon?
Essential oils, probably.
Essential oils, you know, and are there regulations and requirements that we have to meet in order to do that? And so we're in the process of, you know, looking at the various sources of regulations to see if for some reason they fall within or we can get an exemption from complying with certain rules and regulations for that. You know, and some of them, of course, will know, like the health industry. You obviously, if you have a restaurant, you need to get a permit. Others, which are a little more esoteric, require a little bit more digging to see what you can find out and where you need to comply and where you don't need to comply.
Well, I imagine that in terms of requirements for intelligent requirements and sometimes legal requirements, you have to get certain types of insurance, like liability insurance.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, insurance is, you know, for better or for worse, a necessity these days. You know, it's hard to imagine going into business with zero insurance. Professional providers need to usually have a malpractice or errors and omission insurance. Any kind of manufacturer has a product insurance to in case there are claims made against them for defective merchandise. There are now policies out there that protect people from claims that are based on labor and discrimination that you can buy a policy. I mean, there's all sorts of insurance that you use. And, you know, you need to make an intelligent decisions about what risks can be covered with insurance, what risks are likely in your particular enterprise, and what risks that you want to insure around.
Now, during the period that you start, and a little before sometimes, there are lots of people you have to deal with, suppliers, landlords, investors, etc. And of course, there are contracts and agreements to be signed and payments to be arranged, sometimes on a regular basis. Do you need a lawyer in these circumstances, in your opinion?
You know, I don't want to give a one-size-fits-all answer, and I usually hate the typical lawyer's office answer of it depends, but it depends.
Ah, okay.
You know, how much, you know, and the things that are involved are, you know, how much legal experience do you have on your own? How much money is at stake? What are your downside risks? Do you understand the terms and the fine print that are in the paper? You know, do you absolutely need one in the sense that it's required by law? No, of course not. You don't. You know, you can draft, you can sign all the paper and all the contracts you want and never speak to a lawyer. If you really want a decent understanding of what this piece of paper says before you're asked to sign it, it may be worthwhile to buy an hour of a lawyer's time, sit down with a lawyer and ask him or her, what does this mean? And if something goes south, what can I do about it? You know, if what you're really talking about is, you know, $2,000, $3,000, $5,000 supply contract for something, no, you don't need a lawyer for that. You know, it doesn't make any sense to spend that kind of money. You know, if you're talking about buying a business at $100,000, $150,000, $200,000, then yeah, it might make some sense. Because there might be things that you don't fully understand or that we should be adding to the contract that would be beneficial to you if things go wrong. And remember, what a contract really does is set down the terms of the agreement so that both sides understand what they're doing and what happens when something goes south. So, you know, that's, you're really looking to try to protect yourselves with the contract. And it comes at a very bad time from a risk management standpoint, because the moment when you sign a contract, you're negotiating, you're optimistic, you're building, you're creating, you're not really thinking about how things go wrong or how things could go wrong with your new supplier, landlord, business partner, what have you. But that's what a contract is for, and that's what a contract does, is to say exactly what's supposed to happen, how it's supposed to happen, and what you're going to do about it if something goes south.
Well, besides contracts and agreements, there's the possibility of different kinds of writing that you might have to engage in. Are there, besides contracts, what other things need to be in writing to protect yourself?
Do you have an example of something you're in mind?
For instance, going over the lease that you might have with the attorney.
A lease would be, you have to realize in my mindset, all of these things where you're talking about the terms of what you're going to do or not going to do are contracts.
Oh, I see.
For me, a lease is really a sort of contract. It just happens to go, for historical reasons, by a different name. And yeah, there are certain differences as to what's a lease and what's a contract. You know, but your insurance policy, for instance, is a type of contract. You know, your arrangement with your partners and your investors is a type of contract. Actually, the bylaws for your corporation is inherently a type of contract as well, if you think about it, because it simply agrees as to how all of the shareholders and officers and directors are going to work together to achieve the common goal of the corporation. Sure, as you get bigger, are there things that you might want to have in writing? Sure, policies and procedures would be useful to have so that there is a sense of consistency throughout the entire organization. You know, as you grow older, you may want to have an employee handbook to set out things that has to how the company is going to treat its employees and its to a lesser extent its contractors, but predominantly its employees and its policies, its disciplinary policies and the like. Obviously, the contracts are there. I think those are the things that those are the probably the predominant things that as you get bigger, you want to have in writing. As a one person shop, do you need any of that? No, not really. You know, policies and procedures, who really cares? It's just you.
It is the 15th century. El Tesoro de Cielo, a Spanish treasure ship, sends a scouting expedition to a strange island. Golden statues surrounding them prove the enormity of their find. Suddenly, hordes of ghoulish creatures with scaly green flesh and skeletal wings descend upon them from the sky.
What do you think of this, Rufio?
These creatures are fragile, Captain. We could take them with our swords.
They seem supernatural. Who knows what powers they possess?
Fallen angels, weakened by their treason.
By God, are you saying they're Nephilim, the devil's host?
I'm saying whatever they are, we can take them. Do any of you cowards dare join me?
Up against sharp knife-like nails and hideous fangs, the men's swords rip into slimy green flesh. Though black blood pours copiously from their half-naked bodies, creatures miraculously persist. Can the crew survive this bloody, cursed battle?
Find out more by Googling The Thrice Born, a new sci-fi supernatural novel by Carlos Lopez Avery and Johnny Bluestar. Google with the words Carlos Johnny Kendall, The Thrice Born. That's Carlos Johnny Kendall, The Thrice Born.
New Galaxy Enterprises is a media company specializing in wide-ranging content like novels, nonfiction books, screenplays, commercial advertising, web content, etc. One of our most esteemed providers is illustrator Robert W. Zalo. I work on all my most important projects like book covers, logos, web design elements with Robert. As an illustrator, he worked on the Ignatz-nominated comic book, The Expert's Guide to Killing Things That Go Bump in the Night. His skills encompass advertising, magazine illustrations, gaming, comic books, TV production, and scenic painting. His clients include Comcast, Adelphia, Haven Talent, Forceworks, High Octane Theater, Star Creative Advertising. If you wish to contact Robert, go to johnnybluestar.com and let me know. That's johnnybluestar.com. For artist, illustrator Robert Zalo, an essential component of all the work we do. Maybe he can help you too.
We're back with attorney Rick Perry, discussing the steps and challenges necessary to opening your own business.
Well, one of the things that I came across, because I dealt a little bit with holistic products, I mean health-oriented products, was that sometimes the advertising in these products might get people in a lot of trouble. And I'm talking about, products that might be like pharmaceutical or medicinal products. Is there a purpose in using a lawyer to go over that sort of possibility of lawsuits or punishments by the government or whatever for breaking certain rules?
Well, obviously there are a lot of laws regarding what you can and you cannot say in advertisement. You obviously cannot lie in advertisements. Your claims have to be true. You know, if you say it has been established that 4 out of 5 dentists, you know, prefer X brand of toothpaste, you have to have some kind of research to suggest that 4 out of 5 dentists, in fact, do make that recommendation. A lot of it is indeed in the advertising realm, you know, common sense. You want to be truthful. Where you probably will want an attorney or somebody who is a skeptic is to say, you know what, you've really gone too far here. You need to tone that back because it steps over the line of what is acceptable. If you don't have a lawyer review it, you at least need somebody there who's going to poke holes and make you say, is this true? Is this true? Is this true? Is this true? And you may need the lawyer's background and the imprimatur of somebody with a degree on it who's got the authority to say, no, you just can't say that.
Right.
Is it absolutely necessary? No, of course not. You know, lots of companies go by, particularly smaller companies, do their advertising without legal review. But, you know, they do run the risk that one of these days some kind of consumer protection agency or authority or the Federal Trade Commission is going to come knocking on their door saying, you know, we have a problem.
Well, another sort of thing that you come across that might require some legal thinking are the complexities involved in hiring employees. Like, what are the things that you need to do to protect yourself from making some kind of grievous mistake?
I think the first place where most small businesses tend to go wrong here is to think that that somebody is an independent contractor when they are in fact an employee. The law divides the people who provide services into those two broad categories. You know, are they an employee or are they an independent contractor? And most small businesses rightly understand that if somebody is labeled an employee, that is going to probably be more expensive from an actual out-of-pocket cost and an administrative cost than if somebody was an independent contractor. What they misunderstand is where that line really is and who is really going to be considered a contractor and who is really going to be considered an employee and what factors are used to make that decision or make that determination. The test is complicated and it's long and I don't want to get into it here, but if I had to look at it from a general overview standpoint, the question is really, is that person who is providing the services really running his or her own business?
I see.
And if he or she, from the standpoint of that, from that person, not really providing his or her own business, then he or she is probably an employee.
I've noticed in the past, and this is not true recently, but when I was in sales, there were a lot of organizations that would try to get you into an independent contractor status. Is that still going on?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, this is a fundamental premise of the new economy models. I mean, you look at companies like Uber, for instance, is trying to say that all of its drivers are independent business people and independent contractors, and they are simply using their software. And this is an enormous fight. It's at least one class action lawsuit in California that I'm aware of. I know that it's gone before the Labor Commission here in California at least twice. And I won't say that Uber's model or Uber lives or dies by this determination, but it is a key role as to, you know, a key question for them and for, you know, the new economy, the gig economy, for instance, that's coming out now. And I think it's still an open question as to whether or not Uber is going to prevail on that particular question. And, you know, I see it in small businesses as well in big businesses.
Well, there's expenses and there's a tremendous amount of bookkeeping involved. There's many more regulations for treating people that can be more significant when you hire somebody as an employee, correct?
Oh, Absolutely. I mean, you know, if once somebody is labeled an employee, you have to worry about minimum wage laws and overtime laws and rest breaks and discrimination laws and, you know, OSHA and all sorts of things that generally you don't have to worry about if somebody is an independent contractor. And that provides a strong motivation for people to, you know, look very hard at that question and see if they can structure their relationship or treat their relationship with somebody as being an independent contractor and not as an employee. And quite interestingly, perhaps of all the factors that the government weighs in making that determination, one of the least important is the ideas and the thinking of the parties involved. In other words, just because the service provider agrees that he is an independent contractor and the person receiving the services says, yes, that person is an independent contractor, does not make them an independent contractor. And that's true even if the agreement in writing between the two says that. You know, we all put that in our independent contractor agreements, but when push comes to shove, the governments, the courts, the state agencies all almost routinely ignore that.
Well, I think, you know, I'm thinking about when I started my small businesses, the various things I did. I never heard a program like this. And I think I wish I had, you know. Well, let's get back to the struggle here. What are the biggest traps that should be avoided in taking first steps in starting one's own business?
Make sure there's enough money behind you to get you up and running. That if there's anything where a business is going to fall apart, that's where it is. They're going to be overly optimistic into what they can achieve given their time, information, and money constraints. And they're going to fall flat, and the one that's going to kill them is money. You know, if you are running on a shoestring, you need to rethink what you're doing, because the odds are you're going to run out and it's going to fail. No, and that's not a legal constraint. I mean, that's not an issue from an attorney's standpoint. That's an entrepreneurial standpoint. You know, and I see it where people say in part, "Oh, lawyers, they cost too much. I'm not going to afford it." And some of those people are, you know, making a rational decision that this is not the time to form their corporation or get the legal advice. They'll just take the risks. And others are just running on too short a shoestring, and they're just going to flat out run out of money.
You know, Rick, I'd like to get back, you know, we've sort of gone over some of this stuff, but I'd like to get more into some of the details about contracts.
Sure.
Now, any small business tends to be supported by various written agreements. In reality, that's sometimes frustrating to someone who loves art and has just opened an art gallery or a fashion designer who just loves their work. Suddenly, these people who love a certain type of work or task, they're submerged in paperwork developed to provide clarity as to their business dealings with clients, suppliers, investors, etc. One question that some people ask is, why in God's name can't I get a simple one to two page contract?
Largely because the world is so complex, and there are so many different ways that things can go south, particularly if what you have is a contract that defines a long-term relationship, a lease, an investor agreement, a partnership arrangement. Those are the kinds of things where there are so many variables and the relationship can go in so many different ways that you really want to think out where the most common problems might be and set down what will happen if those problems arise. For instance, in your partnership arrangement, there is always a lengthy discussion toward the back of the agreement that says what happens when the partnership comes to an end. And spelling out what the various possibilities are if you liquidate things, or if one partner buys out the other, or if one partner dies, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And those things just take a lot of paper and time to explain and to work out, okay?
Yeah.
Other things, there may be simply enough money that's involved that it's worthwhile spelling out certain things. For instance, if it's a large contract and there's a large amount of money at stake, I may want provisions saying, you know, gee, the lawsuit has to be in California, or gee, we're going to arbitrate, or gee, only certain kinds of damages are going to be allowed because you've got a reduction in price, or who knows, or gee, we're going to go to mediation, or gee, we're going to do all of these things, or gee, we're going to, you know, work our way around this particular law that neither of us like. And all of that takes up paper and space. And that's basically why you end up with lengthy agreements.
Patty Greer journeyed to England to investigate crop circles, eventually becoming a filmmaker, chronicling this phenomena and serving as a kind of intermediary between the unknown creators and a humanity on the brink of global disaster. Hear her complete story by visiting Show 1, Patty Greer, Crop Circle Mysteries, in our Threshold Radio Archives in Vegas, AllNetRadio.com, and YouTube. Here's one of our songs.
She's an angel with a bended wing. You know that she is grounded so that she will sing, not fly away. She's an angel with a golden heart. You know that she can make the wind.
Following is from West Side Warrior, the memoir of Ray Boylan, a Korean War veteran and crime fighter. He was there fighting in the world's coldest battlefield when the Chinese communists invaded.
Desperate squad members ran past our foxhole yelling, "Get the hell out of here, there's too many of them!" Again, we saw the Chinese soldiers charging in with opium-induced mindlessness, oblivious of our bullets. Again, we heard the bugles and whistles. Climbing out of our foxhole, Bob dropped two hand grenades behind us, and I threw one over my shoulder. Bullets whizzing by our heads, Bob and I became bolts of lightning flashing across the mountainside. Like a hideous film, desperate scenes like this played out on the Tokong Pass for 3 days. Sometimes I played in the scene. Sometimes I could only watch and wonder if it were real, or if I'd be suddenly jolted out of my trance by an RKO usher saying, "Hey, did you kids sneak in here?"
To acquire this book, Google westsidewarrior.boylan.kindle. Boylan is spelled B-O-Y-L-A-N. That's West Side Warrior, Boylan, Kindle.
Well, going to the details that you would need to cover and what you consider to be a well-written contract.
I mean, a well-written contract, you know, basically says what it needs to say and doesn't say anything more. So it includes the, what does that mean? It includes the basic business terms of the deal, whatever that is. You know, if it's a purchase agreement, it includes, you know, the item being purchased, the price, the financing terms, the interest rates, what happens if payments are late, you know, kind of the nuts and bolts business terms of the whole deal between the parties. It will then include appropriate, and I don't like this phrase, but it's what everybody uses, boilerplate.
Okay.
Basic provisions that should exist in any contract for a significant amount of money or a significant length of time. So it should say things, whose law governs? Is it California or New York or you know, France or some other jurisdiction? It should say perhaps where the lawsuit should be brought, so that everybody knows if there's a problem, the lawsuit's going to be in San Francisco or New Orleans or some other place. It should probably contain a provision that says, this is all the terms of the contracts, there are no side deals, there are no amendments unless they are also in writing. So that's probably another provision that should be in there. If there is a provision about who should indemnify somebody else in case there's a loss to a third party, that should be in there. You know, those are the kinds of things you all find either in general terms and conditions or in the latter part of the contract that generally don't interest business people because they're not the key terms of the deal, but that really interest the lawyers and that really come in handy if and when there is a problem.
What about the difference between some kind of dispute resolution based on arbitration rather than through the courts?
Again, it depends. You know, this is a huge issue for a lot of businesses, and it comes up both with their products that they sell and actually in the labor context where a lot of employees are trying to move everything into arbitration. And I think it's something that needs to be thought through carefully as we gain more experience with arbitration. One of the known downsides of arbitration is that you will pay for your arbitrator, usually by the hour. So you have what is clearly going to be a cost in arbitration that isn't going to exist in the court system. Some arbitrations can be handled without lawyers. But basically, my experience has been is if you need a lawyer or would have a lawyer in the courtroom, you are probably going to want to have a lawyer in the arbitration. So you're not going to save money there. The big argument for arbitration is that it is quicker and less expensive in terms of preparation and trial time. If you have a mass processed dispute, meaning it's the same kind of case over and over and over and over and over again, that may well be true. To the extent that you have kind of an idiosyncratic problem, which often occurs in buy-sell agreements, for instance, in the purchase or sale of a business, it's not true. I mean, the last commercial arbitration I did was 14 and a half months, 15 months.
Whoa.
It involved exchange of documents and attempts at depositions. I could not see where we were saving anybody any time or any money as opposed to going through the courts. I really couldn't.
But psychologically, in looking at it for the ordinary person, it does sound like a good deal, right? Just on a superficial basis.
I don't know that one way or the other. I think what arbitration grows out of is a frustration with the court system, and there is a reason to be frustrated with the court system. You know, the court is not always ideal. You know, but it is the system that we have. And what has happened with arbitration is that it has morphed to be more like the courts, except private.
Right.
So, you know, you have a public system and you have a private system. But that function in very, very similar fashions, at least in terms of business commercial arbitration. You know, and the courts, that's not true. At least the courts in California, not necessarily at the federal level, but at the state level in California, are becoming a little more hesitant about arbitration because they see it as, you know, not necessarily being fair for a number of reasons. One, if you've got a large entity that is always hiring the arbitrator and always having his cases before the arbitrator, the same company who provides the arbitration, there is at least a perception of potential bias, because if the arbitrator starts giving out too many negative rulings, the company can just change arbitrators and change arbitration companies. So there's a sense of forum shopping there. There's a sense of unfairness that perhaps the side with all of the information in a dispute has a huge advantage in arbitration because the ability to force the sharing of information might not be the same.
I want to thank Edgar Ahrens for adding such wonderful music to Threshold Radio. We go out with a strong piece called Van Gover.